Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. All right, on today's Fresnolandia, we have Fresno City Attorney Andrew Jans with us to talk all things City Attorney's Office. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to start with just your role, which I think for a lot of people may be not misunderstood, but not well understood. And I've been around City Hall for a long time. I think historically, in my view, the role of the city attorney has historically been a lot focused on defending the city, contracts, and during your tenure, we've seen a massive change in the city attorney's office. And I'm wondering what if you could talk a little bit more about what functions you've added since you've come to the city attorney's office and sort of the shift in vision.
Sure, thanks. And just for your listeners, the city attorney reports to the city council. So the seven members of the city council are my technical supervisors, but I still need to provide legal advice to the executive branch of the government, which includes the city manager's office and the mayor's office and all of their departments, PD, fire, planning. And so that creates an interesting dynamic in terms of how I have to operate as city attorney. And you are correct. Historically, the city attorney, I think, was very insular. We didn't really have a public face in terms of what we were doing. And so you're right. We worked on things like contracts, resolutions, ordinances, giving legal advice, defending the city when we get sued, which happens a lot. And so when I became city attorney about two years ago, the direction from council was that they wanted a city attorney that was more engaged in the community, that was more forward-thinking, innovative, one who would operate not business as usual. And so we've expanded in a lot of areas. In code enforcement, we're doing a lot of things with other agencies and partners, the Attorney General, Fresno PD, and going after illicit smoke shop activity. We have expanded our criminal prosecutions. We've seen, I think, a need for more prosecutions as it comes to some of the ordinances that the city council has moved to pass.
Okay, let me ask a follow-up on that. So I guess it's a two-part follow-up. How do you know that this is what the community wants? You're changing the approach, right? How do you know that it aligns with the community's goals? And then how do you prevent over-policing?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. And so we live in a representative democracy, and so the seven city council members are elected by the folks who live in their individual districts. And so I get my direction from them. And I'm glad you actually brought that up, because there is sometimes a confusion out there that I am somehow a lawyer for the people of the city of Fresno. Like the DA represents the people of Fresno County. My role is different. I am the lawyer for the city. And so I get my direction from the city council members. And how we know that this is what the community wants is through our elective process. And so if, for example, the individual council members who passed the smoke shop ordinance come around for their next election, people don't like what they did, they have an opportunity to vote them out. And so that's really how I'm held accountable, and that's how the council members are held accountable.
Do you think as the city attorney's office gets more prosecutorial power that there might be an argument to separate the functions of prosecuting cases, pursuing more policy work, versus the civil cases and the defense of the city into two separate functions, like how the DA and the county council are separate at the county?
Yeah, I think that if we continue along the path that we're going in terms of more prosecutorial responsibilities, there's a conversation that's going to be had. Other big cities, Long Beach for an example, and even LA, they've separated those two functions. And so that's really a philosophical question that I think the community and the council need to have. If you have a city attorney that has the power to take away people's freedoms, should that person be independently elected? I'm not going to weigh in on where I stand on that. I'm going to take direction from my seven bosses, and maybe that's a conversation that we'll have down the road.
So if we were to look at kind of a Venn diagram of you and our county DA, how do we think about this, like, structurally? If you're pursuing criminal cases, like, where do those lines meet and separate?
That's a great question. There is definitely some overlap. And so there are conversations that are going on right now at City Hall about codifying parts of the state penal code into our municipal code, which is what some other cities do. And so what that would allow the city attorney's office to do is to prosecute a wide variety of misdemeanor cases. We have the ability to do that now. The district attorney has the ability to deputize other attorneys who are in the city of Fresno and the county to prosecute cases. That hasn't happened yet. I know we've had some discussions around that as a possibility. So there's overlap in terms of property crimes. There are some overlap in terms of, for example, the copper wire ordinance that was passed jointly by the city and the county last week.
So you imagine it to be a collaborative relationship in some ways?
I hope that it would be. We've already offered to take some cases from the district attorney so they can focus on important cases. Not that all cases aren't important, but serious cases, violent crimes, murders, sexual assaults, those types of cases. And we would be willing to take on some of the lesser crimes, such as property theft. And when I say lesser crimes, these are crimes that we receive complaints on all the time through the council members, through their offices. When you get something stolen off your porch, your Amazon delivery, your FedEx delivery, it really pisses people off. And there's a perception out there, for whatever reason, that those crimes aren't being prosecuted right now.
And would that be crimes that fall under the new classification under Prop 36? Could you talk a little bit more about how that plays into this too?
Yeah, sure. So we are prohibited under state law to, at least at this point, to do any, and when I say we, a city attorney's office, to do anything more than misdemeanors. And so what Prop 36 did was change certain crimes back to felonies. Repeat offenders, certain drug cases would become felonies. And so those would not be cases that we handle. And those would be cases that should be sent to the DA's office. And since you brought it up, there's been some news this week. For whatever reason, we've seen in Fresno County is one of the counties that have used Prop 36 the least. It's interesting because we have a district attorney that was front and center in campaigning for this new state law. And I think a lot of people are very eager to have more prosecutions and more people held accountable under Prop 36. It was overwhelmingly popular, especially here in Fresno County. And so we're looking and waiting to see how we can best help the DA there.
Okay. Given that there's programmatic changes with how you're operating the office, do you have the resources to expand this amount of criminal prosecutions?
The council has indicated to me that they will provide the resources necessary to take on all of these new tasks. Those are conversations that we're going to have now moving into budget season in May and in June. Last year, the council set aside, I believe, around $100,000 to start building up a prosecution unit.
$100,000?
Yes.
And that's, for a prosecution unit?
That's just start. That's
is
literally.
That like,
start.
Is that like a
it's
half?
The cost yeah, of lunch,
yeah.
maybe?
Yeah. No, so I'll definitely be working with the council to beef up that team given the additional responsibilities.
So how do you balance, going back to this, where your allegiances lie, if you will, how do you balance having seven bosses, also in a strong mayor form of government? A lot of the city's functions are still nestled under the mayor. So you have eight bosses, if you will. How does that play out in your day-to-day?
It's incredibly difficult. I have to essentially silo all of my conversations because there's something called attorney-client privilege. I can have a conversation with one council member and not necessarily be allowed to share it with another. And so sometimes I am literally working on two projects that are in conflict with one another because there's one council member maybe that wants to do something this way and another council member that wants to do it that way. And so that does become challenging. What I will say is that the council members individually understand the unique and difficult role that I'm in. And so they've given me that flexibility to have obviously those confidential conversations with the council members and the mayor and the city manager as well. It's every day is a tough balancing act. And the way that I try to get through the day is to just remember who my client is, and that is the city of Fresno.
So when you think about expanding the reach and scope of your job, there's a lot of discussions nationally around guardrails, expanding executive power. Are you concerned that in the future, if we expand the power of the city attorney, successors to you could use that for nefarious ends?
Obviously, that's a possibility. It would be the role of the city council then to keep their city attorney in line. That is their function. They oversee only two departments, the city clerk and the city attorney. And so if the city attorney gets out of line, I would expect the council to rein him back in, him or her.
So I'd love to shift into a different topic about how politics meshes and sometimes intersects with your role. And so there was this recent campaign mailer sent out in the Brandon Vang city council race for District 5. The mailer was sent by a PAC that was not registered with the city initially. There was a lot of outrage and people pushed on your office to investigate. You then did. And eventually it got to a place where the person, Alex Tavlian, was behind the pack. And I'm just curious, it took a lot of steps, a lot of people weighing into the discussion, a lot of reporting before we got to a point where someone is connected and held accountable for a mailer that had a lot of potentially false information in it. And so I'm just curious if you could comment on how do we prevent these types of situations happening again, where sort of nefarious forces are trying to influence elections in really shadowy ways?
I don't think that I'm stepping out of my lane when I say that I think that we could strengthen our local campaign finance laws. Elections are so important to our form of government, and I believe firmly that the more restrictions we have in terms of how money is spent in our politics is so important to protecting just the way we live. And so I'll obviously be having conversations with the council in terms of where they want to go. Obviously, they are the policymakers.
Yeah, do you think there's the political will to do this?
I don't know. We've hadn't had the opportunity yet. Brandon just got sworn in, and I'm anticipating having some conversations about how this all went down and how we can improve in the future. We have a really unique system where usually in situations like this, the state is in charge of investigating these types of offenses. And so they've basically said, look, because our campaign finance laws are so different from state laws, they've left it up to basically my office to police this. And that you could think of a situation where I'm potentially investigating one of my own bosses. So that really creates a weird situation for me and my investigators. And so those are conversations that we're going to have. The city clerk obviously is involved in this as well. We've had a practice of how we operate our elections and how money is raised and how money is reported. And I always think that we can make those laws stronger. But again, I'm not the policymaker. That's really going to be up to council, I think, at the end of the day. Unless there's a voter initiative that comes forward, that's another opportunity.
I was just going to say, given the fact that you, like you said, it might be really awkward to have to investigate one of your bosses, do you think that there's a potential role to play for a more independent body that doesn't have that sort of inherent...
Ethics commission.
Yeah, or some sort of investigative role.
That is definitely an option. And we just need someone to put that in place.
What?
Yeah, how would the ethics commission have teeth, though?
I think that the city council's policymakers would have to empower them with subpoena power, investigatory powers, to have to figure out how you could make this commission truly independent. Right. There's all kinds of ways to do it.
That would possibly require a city charter reform. You said something earlier about how the state's campaign finance laws are really different from the city's, which is why the state has devolved responsibility. And that's new to me. Could you explain a little bit more about how that's the case?
Yeah, so essentially this is what they've told us. So basically they've said that our laws are different from theirs. And so for whatever reason, I don't know, I've not spoken to anybody personally at FPPC, but that is the direction that they've given us. And I don't think they've really gone into detail why. And I don't know if it's a workload issue, a resource issue, but that's just what we've been told.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Something that I've observed, we follow a lot of campaign finance at Fresno Land, is that we've seen an emergence more recently of dark money, so to speak, LLCs that are donating to campaigns. It's hard to figure out who the donors are behind it. And I'm curious if you both agree that's a trend that you've seen, and if so, what's behind the shift?
Man, this is the first campaign finance violation that I've investigated since I've become city attorney.
Okay.
In all honesty, I don't know if I'd be the right person to weigh in on that because I haven't been following.
Yeah.
The last campaign finance thing that I was involved with was the situation where the county sued two council members who were campaigning for supervisor for transferring money. And we were partially involved in that because we wanted to seek clarification on what the laws were because it would have an impact on our municipal code. But I don't know if I'm the right person to talk about that. I've really not been following money in politics locally.
Okay.
Since 2020.
But on the same token, isn't your office also responsible for making sure that council members are observing the state's pay-to-play laws and making sure that if they're receiving campaign donations from different individuals, that they're not also voting on those?
That is absolutely not our responsibility.
Okay.
They have an independent responsibility, and I have to remind them of this all the time, to police their own rules, because at the end of the day, the FPPC, if you're engaging in any type of activity that they're involved in, if a complaint goes to them, then that's on them to figure out on their own. And remember, my client is the city. It's not the individual campaigns or the council members' campaigns. We do, from time to time, provide advice, but we make it very clear to them, look, if you want real advice, you got to go to FPPC.
Oh, that's so interesting. So if a council member...
So they enforce their own...
They're expected to know... A lot of them have their own attorneys on the campaign side of things, and so they're expected to know the law. They're expected to know how to file all their own paperwork and things like that. I know that the clerk will assist them in terms of any city filings that they need to have, but again, that's not our role.
And so if a council member, in their capacity as a city council member, or let's just even say it's a planning commission, doesn't matter in this example, they vote on a project and that it turns out later that they accepted a hypothetical donation from someone that exceeded the limit that the state law says that they're supposed to give or accept from someone who has business in front of the council, because that could potentially affect the legality of that vote. When does your office say, this is not good?
Yeah, so in that circumstance, that would be my responsibility.
Got it.
Because, again, I'm supposed to protect the city. And so if you are putting the city in legal risk, or an ordinance, if you're passing an ordinance that might not stand up in court, that's where I can become involved. And so we do our best to try to warn the individual council members of any potential conflicts that are out there. But again, we don't know who's donating money to them necessarily on a day-to-day basis. And so again, they're partially responsible for that. But in terms of protecting the city, I can get involved in that situation, that scenario that you just laid out.
Got it.
Interesting. This feels very murky because you got eight bosses and then you're protecting the city, whatever that means exactly.
It feels really messy. And now another question I had is the DA's office has this public integrity unit where they're also supposed to be investigating these tip for issues of corruption or campaign finance. Does your office ever refer cases to them?
We have not, to my knowledge, I have not, as city attorney, referred a case to them. I have when folks have filed a complaint with my office that doesn't belong with my office, I will tell the complaining party, hey, maybe you might want to look at the public integrity unit. But I have not sent the DA any cases in terms of public integrity. There are sometimes situations where maybe the police department might refer cases to them, but not my office.
Do you think the public integrity unit's going to act as a deterrent?
A deterrent to what? I'm sorry.
A deterrent to bad behavior, what we're describing. We're talking about the public integrity unit.
People sending mailers with questionable information in them.
Or do you think we need some example cases in order to have true deterrence?
Yeah, I think that in this circumstance, let's just use the Alex Tavlian situation as an example. So I don't know if a complaint was filed with the DA. I heard that there was one, but I haven't seen anything. In terms of deterrence, the law's already on the books, and that should be a deterrence enough.
In theory,
yeah.
Paid the fine yet?
Not yet. I think he has until June. I gave him 90 days.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's a murky area. I hope that we see more discussion on this. So we want to switch to talking about the city's camping ban and how the prosecution of that. And this is not going to be a surprise to you. A lot of people raised a lot of eyebrows when the first prosecution for the city's ban on camping in public spaces was this senior citizen, Wiki Two Hands. He works on the side still. Could you explain, as the city undertakes enforcing this law, why he was chosen as the first person to prosecute, and if he's the person that you guys are trying to go after when you think about this?
Yeah, so I think it's actually the opposite. He wasn't the first person we prosecuted. The way that this got to trial is that the defense attorney pushed it to trial. And I would look at it the other way around. This is the case that the defense bar essentially picked to be the first one to highlight.
I see.
Obviously, sympathetic defendant, 77 years old, partially blind, living out in the streets. I think in the defense's eyes, a good test case. I thought it was a good test case for us in terms of making sure that when we end up in front of an appeals court, or even if this goes back up to the Supreme Court, that we have a case with good facts. And so if I can just digress a little bit in terms of what we did with the camping ordinance and what the council did with the camping ordinance, is that the Supreme Court had said that we cannot criminalize someone based on their housing status. But they have said that you can punish behavior. And so the city council crafted an ordinance in a way to comply with a Grants Pass decision, which Grants Pass is a city in Oregon, I believe, and we've basically mimicked their ordinance and built it into our municipal code. And so in this instance involving Mr. Two Hands, we had a situation where two people were actually arrested at the same time. And just as a side note, they were offered services and housing prior to the arrest. But we thought that this would have been a good test case in terms of, and from the city's perspective, because Mr. Two Hands was admittedly unhoused, and an individual that was sitting next to him on the sidewalk was also arrested. He had housing. And so we would have been able to demonstrate on appeal or up at the Supreme Court that we treated these two individuals equally based on behavior that they were engaged in. And the example that I always like to use is this law would apply equally to anybody. Let's say you had a drunk or an intoxicated college student sleeping on a bus stop. He would have been held accountable under this same law the way that Mr. Two Hands was. And that would have been the argument we would have made if this went up on appeal. And I'm trying to remember what your original question was. I started just doing this.
I get what you're saying in terms of there were prosecutions before this. This was the one that the defense attorney decided to take all the way to trial.
Yep.
I get that. But I think from a public, just from an optics perspective, you have an older man who is still working. We all, none of us are arguing about systemic issues around homelessness. And so does it make sense to...
About perception strategy a
little
bit?
Yeah, okay. And so does it make sense to...
I guess the bigger question is, what's the outcome you hoped from this? What would result from this that would move your strategy forward in terms of the campaign?
Thanks for saving me.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you asked that question. And this is a strategy that the mayor's office and the city council has asked that we employ in terms of prosecuting these cases. And this is the most frustrating thing to me about this whole situation, is that leading up to trial, on the eve of trial, we had a bed and services in place for this gentleman in exchange for a plea deal that would be supervised by a judge. The disappointing thing is that the defense would have rather had a technical win in court and a situation where Mr. Two Hands is now back out on the streets with no services, no place to sleep at night. So to answer your question, the outcome I wanted was to get this guy help. And sometimes you have to use the criminal justice system to craft a plea deal or craft an outcome in a way that helps somebody. Not everyone is high functioning like you and I. Some people just need that little bit of extra supervision to get them what they need. And so I'm just really frustrated that he's potentially back out in the streets with no help when we had this deal in place.
But don't you think part of the problem is that while you were able to craft that deal so that Wiki Two Hands could potentially have housing and services, we all know the shelters are full most of the time. We all know that there's not always permanent housing at the end of the tunnel for most people that are in the shelter, should they even get through the shelter system. And so it doesn't address the systemic issue
it
of
does
housing.
Not. It does not. It does not.
Yeah.
The systemic issue, it's...
And that's not really your purview necessarily
no,
as a city attorney to fix the policy issue.
Yeah.
Sure.
Sorry. We're arguing with each other.
Yeah. I'm not. Yeah. Poverty is.
Are you going to solve poverty, yes. Andrew?
But there is this thing that we don't necessarily solve poverty. We don't solve housing by prosecuting it either. And I think I appreciate that you're trying to. There are some people who are on the streets that maybe they're drug users, maybe they have severe mental health issues, and they're not diverting into the system for a lot of reasons. I get that you're trying to use the criminal justice system to push people in a path that they're resistant to, but Wiki Two Hands isn't that. He doesn't fit that stereotype.
The profile. Yeah. So what are the lessons you're taking from this going forward for future cases?
Besides not subpoenaing reporters.
You learn the most from the cases that you lose. Well, I think we'll try to be more forceful in terms of maybe more creative in terms of getting housing options and services to folks.
Are you going to appeal?
I don't know yet. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't see how that would help Mr. Two Hands. That'll be a decision that we have to make, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact, too, that we have a council that is accountable to their voters, and they have a lot of constituents, a lot of folks who own small businesses that have been frustrated with the lack of any type of progress in moving these people off the sidewalks in front of their stores. And so there's a victim in this.
Totally.
And so we can't lose sight of the fact that like people are fed up and frustrated with with sort of the status quo.
And we had Pablo on our staff reported a story about the business perspective and how they feel that the ordinance...
It was a really good story.
Yeah, how a lot of business owners do feel like the ordinance is effective. But there's this tension of even the business owners are like, it's great, we don't have to clean up.
But they feel bad about the prosecution side of things.
So a few years ago, before you came into the city attorney's office, the council decided to take the office of the code enforcement and put it under the city attorney's office. And we've seen a lot of different changes over the last few years in terms of how we go after slumlords and prosecute them. And I was struck, there was a council discussion in March where on the dais, multiple very well-known slumlords were named as repeat offenders and problematic offenders. And someone from your staff was affirming this. And it just strikes me that we all know who the bad actors are, and you have a lot more enforcement powers than you used to. So why is it so difficult to shut them down?
They are appealing every single citation that we've issued. And so part of the problem is the citations, I think, are not... They need to be bigger. Citations need to be bigger because it's the cost of doing business for them. And so that's one thing that we're looking at. Another avenue that we are pursuing are receiverships. This is a process that where if we can demonstrate to a judge or a court that these folks are repeat offenders, the court has an ability to appoint a receiver to take over the property, to take that property away from the slumlord. And
that would be a deterrent.
Yeah, and sell absolutely. It. So that is what we are looking at implementing starting in the next fiscal year. I'm hoping to, and it seems like the council would be supportive of that. Obviously, we need resources to fund that team. Receiverships are very labor, time intensive. And I think that is going to be a creative approach to dealing with this issue. And I think you're going to hear more about it in the coming months.
How pervasive is this? I'm trying to ask about size and scope.
Yeah, sure. So we call it tier one. So we've done a citywide inspection of all rental properties, and it's taken us, I want to say 4 or 5 years to get that done. And so we've been able to identify all of the bad actors. And so we need to move on to tier two. In order to move on to tier two, in terms of beefing up the inspections, we need those increased fines that I was talking about. To answer your question, I've been out with my code enforcement team, and I've been to properties where you feel like you're in a third world country. It is people with like dirt floors and roofs caving in. And so, yeah, the problem is so pervasive. And again, I go back to it, the fines that we're issuing, it's just the cost of doing business for them.
Okay. Why do you go on the ride-alongs? Is it for you want to see it yourself? Is it helping people to know what to look for? What's the purpose of you going on?
There are multiple purposes. When I became city attorney, I promised to be a little bit more transparent in terms of what our office does, especially code enforcement. And I guess you're alluding to my post on social media.
Yeah.
I want the public to see what we do. Number two, I want to be able to see firsthand what my troops are doing out there. And I want my employees to know that I care about their assignments. And the biggest thing for me is we need to get the word out there that this is a real problem. And I've found that social media is, in my prior life, is a good tool to do that.
What's your prior life?
My prior political life.
When receiverships can be controversial, we saw a receiver take over the La Hacienda mobile home park, and that did not necessarily end very well for a lot of the residents. And are there ways that as the city goes into thinking about receivership that there can be guardrails against just kicking everyone out and converting everything to market rate?
Yeah, so I would slightly disagree with your assessment of La Hacienda, okay, because the entity that screwed up the park was the new owner. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the receiver that screwed it up. It was the new owner. So we went through this process, and now we're in a situation where I think because of the city, the residents that are living there, I think that they're very supportive of what we've been doing. They're coming to court and thanking our attorneys for stepping up and getting a judge involved and crafting this new deal where a new operator is going to come in and own the park.
But the receiver was part of the selection for that new owner that ended up being pretty horrible.
Yeah, correct. And that's why we have the court process, and we went through the process again, and now we think we're going to have a better operator.
Yeah. I'm optimistic, but it was very messy for
years. Yeah, and it took a long time, which is, I know, frustrating for many of the residents.
Yeah.
We end these podcasts in the same way every week with what we're loving this week. Donnie, do you have something you're loving this week?
Sure. So I will start with a book that you gave me that I finally finished called Meditations for Mortals. And I hate meditation. I'm a really anxious, neurotic person, but I hate meditation. I am starting to try to figure out how to like yoga. But the whole book is basically 28 chapters that are very short, and they tell you in 28 different ways how to accept that you're always going to be in a sucky life, and that's okay. And it's clicked for me. So
yeah, that's a great jacket blurb right there.
Anyways,
accept the suckiness.
There's one line early on in the book that's, you just need to accept that you're not on a plane that is maybe crashing. The plane has already crashed, and your whole life is accepting that the plane has crashed, and now you have to figure out what to do with it.
It is liberating.
As a recovering perfectionist, I like it a lot. So thank you for the book.
Andrew, what about you? What are you loving this week?
Oh, man, I'm so lame. I'm loving the weather. I have roses in front of my house, and they are beautiful right now. And waking up every morning and looking at them is nice.
That's wonderful.
Are you playing any video games right now?
Are you a gamer?
A little bit. No, okay, not really.
What kind of video games do you like?
The last one I played was like Red Dead, I think.
Oh, one or two?
Two.
Oh, one of the greatest games of all time.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it.
It is an open world Western video game that is just mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, there's like hunting and crafting and...
Do everything.
You can be a bounty hunter.
If they want to plug me in the Matrix there with some immortality clauses, I'd be into it.
Yeah.
Okay.
What I'm loving this week, when I met my partner, I was a vegan, and she was not. And she coaxed me into meat consumption. But recently I've wanted to temper that a little bit and have more kind of veggie meals throughout the week. So I found this great guy. His name is like handle on Instagram is Alfie Cooks. And I struggle sometimes with feeding my partner who likes like meat, kind of has this satisfaction element that sometimes a veggie forward meal does. This guy does incredible things with veggies. And so I've tried a bunch of his recipes recently, and yeah, there was this one that was like a miso bean with asparagus on top. It was incredible. So I'm trying to eat a little bit less meat these days. And so I'm always looking for places to and recipes and cookbooks to help me with that.
I'm told that's good for the planet.
I've heard the same thing.
Don't take Mega Texas away from me.
No, I'm not. This is not a universal thing. This is Tuesday, Thursdays on the weeknights. So anyway, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, this was fun. Thanks.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.